You're listening to the Parking Podcast. Views and opinions are my own. This episode is brought to you by Parking Today and the Parking Today Podcast Network. Learn more at parkingtoday.com/podcast. This episode is brought to you by Scheid & Bachmann USA. Scheid & Bachmann USA markets state-of-the-art parking solutions and fare collection systems, the most innovative and advanced solutions in the U.S. Learn more at scheidandbachmann.com.
Hey there, this is Brian Wolf with Parker Technology, a sponsor for the Parking Podcast. Parker Technology is the customer experience solution of choice for the parking industry. Our solution puts a virtual ambassador in every lane to help parking guests pay and get on their way in under a minute. Whether you utilize our customer service team or your team in conjunction with our software platform, or a combination of both, we help you capture revenue, provide better customer service, enable your staff to focus on higher priority tasks, and most importantly, keep your traffic moving. With the Parker Technology solution, you'll also enjoy real-time access to call data and recordings. Learn more at parkertechnology.com/parking podcast and subscribe to our podcast, Harder Than It Looks, Parking Uncovered.
Welcome back to another episode of the Parking Podcast. So we are in the month of May, which is Mental Health Awareness Month. So I wanted to highlight one of our previous episodes that discuss mental health coming from a parking professional, Russell Harms. The episode is episode 128, an interview with Russell Harms and a conversation about euphoric misery, which is the name of his book, where he told the story of his mental health challenges after being diagnosed with bipolar. Got a lot of positive feedback on it. I hope you check out the episode. But in addition, for today's episode, I wanted to share the first three chapters from Russell's book, Euphoric Misery. Russell is kind enough to allow me to share the audiobook here on the podcast. So I hope you can sit back and listen to this teaser about a book I believe every parking professional should own, Euphoric Misery.
Euphoric Misery, written by Russell Harms, narrated by Grant Banker. Dedication. To my wife, Jessica, you're my angel sent from heaven. Thank you for standing beside me, often in front of me, through good times and bad, for helping me find my way back again and again. Your compassion and grace have helped me through the darkest of times. I love you. To my sons, my two beautiful boys, you're my everything. I would not be here if it weren't for you. I want you to remember that life will inevitably knock you down, and the most important thing is that you get back up. Never be too proud to ask for help. Learn from my mistakes, and always, always hug your mom and tell her how much you love her. Disclaimer and trigger warning. This book contains explicit content, including mention of suicide. Please take care of yourself while reading and pause or take a break if needed. Names, dates, dialogue, and other details of this book may have been modified. Russell Harms, the author of this book, is not, nor does he claim to be, a licensed medical professional. This book is not meant to replace therapy or medical advice. As always, consult with your medical team, family, and support system when making decisions for your well-being and mental health. Prologue. A disturbing 22% of Americans, roughly 50 million people, experience mental illness each year. That means that one out of every five people in the United States suffers from a wide range of mental health conditions, including depression, anxiety, mood disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder, and more. A 2023 National Alliance on Mental Illness study revealed that 1 in 25 adults in the United States 10 million people are living with serious mental illness. Half of those who are suffering never receive treatment due to lack of education, resources, and insurance. Mental illness does not discriminate. No one is immune. While I believe we have made great strides in the last several decades to destigmatize mental health, there is still a tremendous amount of stigma and shame associated with mental illness. Many times, we have no idea that people close to us are struggling, and often, they hide it well. It could be a family member, your neighbor, the person behind you in line at the grocery store, a close coworker, or even your boss. It was me. I was the guy behind you in line at the store, pretending to shop for groceries, but secretly buying liquor to drown the pain away. I was your neighbor who waved as you walked by on your morning stroll, faking a smile to hide the shame of my marriage falling apart. I was your coworker, responsible for hundreds of people and millions of dollars in a corporate setting, spiraling into manic episodes under the guise of working harder, faster, stronger. I was in misery without a clue. I was euphoric without a reason. I was in excruciating pain, slowly withering away over two decades, never believing that the highs and lows would ever go away. But I was wrong. I've hid the truth of this part of my life for years, but I refuse to remain silent any longer in hopes that sharing my journey may help others. My hope is that someone might pick up this book and realize they don't have to hide either. This is life beyond euphoric misery. Chapter 1. Southern Love. I've had two great loves in my life, and I almost lost them both to mental illness. Not once, not twice, but countless times. My first great love, entrepreneurship, started in a small town in western New York. Although my family was native Texans, we spent almost 7 years of my childhood in Canandaigua, a small town an hour outside of Rochester. As a kid, I spent most of my free time working at a small, family-owned Italian restaurant named Sam's, washing dishes and delivering pizzas. I wanted to work. I loved work. I liked the feeling of earning my own money, and I was ravenous to learn. This is where my love for food and cooking came from. I eventually helped make fresh pizzas from scratch, pastas, and other Italian favorites. Unfortunately, we had to move right before my senior year of high school. We returned to Burnett, Texas, and moved back into the very same house we had lived in before we left. My parents had rented it out while we lived in New York. Maybe some part of them always knew we'd be back. The house was small, a modest 3-bedroom home with only one full bathroom for the 4 of us to share, but we loved it. At the same time, my older sister Melissa went off to college at Monmouth University, New Jersey, so ultimately, it was just my parents and me. I didn't realize at the time what an impact this move would have on my social life. I've been with my New York friends since the 5th grade. I knew I would miss them, but I didn't realize the transition back into my school in Texas would be so hard. I assumed I'd pick up right where I left off with my childhood friends. I was wrong. Despite knowing all the students from before, I was still the new kid. I didn't fit in at all. My graduating class was less than 100 students, and they had been together their whole lives. I was the outcast. This was so strange for me. I'd always been a sociable guy, and I didn't understand what had changed. To cope, I kept my head down and minded my own business. I'd go to class, then work at a local restaurant. If I could keep busy at work, maybe the loneliness wouldn't get to me. What I discovered was that my social skills paid off at work. I was a customer service guru, and I loved connecting with the people I worked with. After graduating high school, my parents and I moved to South Austin. By the age of 18, I was working in hotels and grinding my way into the hospitality industry. I was in love. I fit into the hotel world seamlessly. I could quickly discern guest moods and needs and knew most of the regulars by name. I worked as much overtime as possible and took home cash tips daily. While most kids from my high school went to college after graduation, I built my resume and worked towards a career. I was determined to be a leader. In 1994, I worked as a bellman and shuttle driver for the Holiday Inn in Austin on the famous Town Lake. My shift started at 4:30 a.m., and I was always the first one there. My job was to shuttle airline crews from the hotel to the airport, and I loved it. I got tipped $1 by each pilot and 50 cents from the flight attendants, which added up to a huge chunk of change for an 18-year-old in the 90s. I enjoyed always having money in my pocket and not having to wait 2 weeks to get paid. As fun as it was, there didn't seem to be much opportunity for advancement. I kept grinding and eventually got hired to be a bellman at the luxurious Omni Hotel in downtown Austin. I had never seen anything like the Omni Hotel. As a kid, we always stayed in a Motel 6 or a Days Inn. The Omni catered to the upper echelon of corporate and leisure travelers, exactly who I wanted to serve and one day be. Weekdays were typically filled with citywide convention guests and affluent business travelers. Weekends were hectic with extravagant weddings and people coming from around the globe to enjoy the live music capital of the world. The hotel was situated 2 blocks from the world-famous 6th Street, which to this day is lined with bars and restaurants where many musicians landed their first big break. It was not uncommon to see celebrities on a regular basis at the Omni. I quickly learned that most of them just wanted to be treated like normal people. They would often use an alias, and we were trained to use whatever name they registered under. Omni also taught us never to ask for an autograph and to respect their privacy. Over the years, I accumulated a list several pages long of celebrities I had the opportunity to meet. Governor George W. Bush before he was president, Natalie Portman, Beyonce, Denzel Washington, and Quentin Tarantino, to name a few. It was an impressive group of people, and most were extremely kind. My favorite celebrity memory was meeting a young Matt Damon in 1996. This was before he and best friend Ben Affleck earned international stardom for their first Oscars in Good Will Hunting. Matt was filming Courage Under Fire, and most of the cast and crew stayed with us for months. Every morning at 5 a.m. sharp, I deliver close to 400 newspapers to guest rooms. One morning, I was arranging bundles of newspapers on my bell cart when Matt ran past me in what looked like several layers of sweatshirts. What on earth is this guy doing running in all those clothes in Texas in September? The next morning, he ran by again, this time stopping to check the headlines of the paper on my cart. I smiled and started to say good morning as I did to all our guests. "Good morning, Mr. Diamond. Would you like a paper?" He smiled and waved his hand. "No thanks, Russell. Got to get my run in." Over the course of the next few weeks, we'd make small talk, and one day I finally asked him why he was wearing so many sweatshirts on his run. He laughed and said, "Oh, my character, a soldier in Desert Storm, has been traumatized in Iraq and become addicted to heroin. I need to lose 40 pounds in a short amount of time." We chuckled together and he went on his way. For months, I watched Matt commit daily to his runs and roll. Here was a man so dedicated and committed to his passion that he was willing to endure misery to accomplish his goals. And I was determined to do the same. The cast and crew on the film were down-to-earth and fascinating people. They were working hard to earn a living, and I respected them for their discipline. They often invited me to play pool with them in the lobby bar, which I had to get special permission to do from our general manager. Something about Matt stood out to me. He was grounded but determined, kind and humble, and dedicated to his craft. I followed his career over the next several years, and every time another box office success hit the screens, I'd reflect on those 5 a.m. chats and feel a sense of gratitude to have witnessed the work ethic of someone so talented. My second great love Jessica walked into the Omni Hotel lobby one morning in 1998, and I haven't taken my eyes off her since. I was working my first management position, overseeing guest services and leading the bellman, concierge, and valet attendants. One morning, I was with her team in the lobby, and I saw Jess behind the front desk. "She's new," I thought. "I've never seen her before. I would have remembered that smile." The bellman started hoaxing me to go talk to her, and after a few boyish shoves and laughs, I found the courage to say hello. I honestly don't remember what I said to her. I was so nervous, and she was so pretty. She was the most vivacious part of the lobby. I don't know if it was her bouncy curly hair or her inviting energy, but she made the entire room feel alive. We started talking, or rather fumbling our words, to try and balance the flirting we both wanted to do with the professionalism we both knew was required. "When did you start working here? Where are you from? How old are you? Can I even ask that?" I had so many questions. I felt like I needed to know everything about her. She mesmerized me. "Oh, I'm from just outside Minneapolis," she said quietly. Is she nervous or just shy? She seemed introverted. Reserved, maybe a little timid, I wanted to be gentle with her, like a flower that needed just the right amount of sun and water to open up. I graduated college a year ago and thought, I don't want to do what everyone else is doing back home. I want something different for my life. So I packed all I owned in two suitcases and got on the next flight here. I had no idea what I'd do, but here I am. Here you are. Oh, I was smitten. Every day I'd find time to flirt with her at the front desk. She was ambitious, bold. I wanted to spend more time with her, but I had no game. Had never been skilled at interacting with women and had no clue how to ask her out. One night, I worked up the nerve to invite Jess and her friend to hang out at my house. That felt safe. At least if she didn't like me, her friend would be there as a buffer. Jess and I ended up sitting on the tailgate of my truck in the driveway talking, and I decided to make a move. "So, what kind of guys have you dated in the past?" "Oh, why did I ask that? God, she probably thinks I'm so dumb." She smiled and looked at me before answering. "Oh, she looks so pretty on the tailgate of my truck." "Well, in college, I usually liked tall, blonde, blue-eyed guys." Yikes. I looked down at myself. I was a chubby 22-year-old country boy who'd never gone to college, trying to find my way in the service industry with premature gray hairs and brown eyes. No way would she go for me. To my surprise, she started giggling, so I did too. Does she actually like me? For the next several minutes, we sat in the back of my truck and laughed. To this day, I don't know if she had just responded that way as a joke or if she was serious. But the contrast in her response and the shared laughter helped break the ice. We spent the rest of the night curled up in the bed of the truck talking about our dreams, our futures, and all we wanted in our lifetime. Soon after, Jess invited me to join a few friends at her place to celebrate New Year's Eve. We rang in 1999 with board games and something I had never heard of, Brandy Slushies. Maybe it was a Minnesota thing. Either way, I was head over heels and would have drunk a vinegar-flavored slushie if she gave me one. 3 days later, we went on our first official date, dinner at Joe's Crab Shack in North Austin. We cracked crab legs and licked butter off her fingers while wearing silly plastic bibs and laughed until they closed. Cracking crab legs and laughing into the night became a staple in our relationship. I was constantly looking for ways to woo Jess and thought, I might be able to swing us a dinner reservation through my hotel employee benefits. The vibrant restaurant community in downtown Austin had an incentive program for the local hotel employees to refer guests to their establishments. One of my favorite things to do was help visitors decide where to grab a good steak, fine Italian cuisine, or legendary barbecue just blocks from the Omni. In the process, I had forged great relationships with the local restaurant managers. I wondered if they could hook me up with dinner reservations. I had no idea these restaurants would end up treating us like royalty. They gave us VIP seating, special off-the-menu dishes sent from the chef, and in most cases, everything was comped. One time I left a $100 tip just so I didn't look like a chump when they refused to bring us a bill. After several instances like this, Jess looked at me and said, "Who are you?" We'd often attend concerts together at Stubbs Barbecue in South Park Meadows and saw performances by Macy Gray, the Dave Matthews Band, and her favorite band, Big Head Todd and the Monsters. This was the late 90s. Cell phones were not the norm yet, and the internet was still fairly new. So, in true form, we would leave each other handwritten notes, sharing how we couldn't wait to see each other after work and what we would venture into next. Over the next several years, we traveled everywhere and anywhere we could together. We made sure to take advantage of Omni's generous employee discount and stay in their hotels nationwide. We rode roller coasters in Orlando, ate Italian food on cafe patios in Manhattan, and saw the Yankees play ball. On the 4th of July, we ventured off the beaten path of a hiking trail in Denver. We discovered beautiful waterfalls tucked in the mountains in search of a grassy patch to watch the fireworks. When we got there, I realized we were too far away to actually hear them, and I felt like I'd let Jess down. "Ah, shoot, I'm so sorry, Jess. We can't hear the fireworks from here." Jess looked at me with a huge grin. She took a swig of her Coors, fitting as they're based in Colorado, stood up, put her hands to her mouth, and shouted, "Bang! Pop! Boom!" I beamed at her, and she beamed back. Jess was the fireworks. Chapter 2: Lost in Hospitality. Over the next several years, my career grew and my health declined. I was starting in Omni's robust management development program. My goal was to one day be a general manager, and this program was the perfect roadmap. It required participants to gain experience in all areas of the hospitality scene. I'd proven my expertise in the front of the house, but I had no experience in the other departments. I was promoted to oversee the housekeeping department, which is a required prerequisite in hospitality to grow. It would be my responsibility to lead the room attendants, porters, and laundry staff. I spent the first week observing the current operations and getting a feel for the flow of each day. I learned the typical hotel requires housekeepers to clean 16 rooms per day on average. I can't even clean one room per day. Trust me, I tried. Housekeepers don't just change the sheets and add fresh towels. They wipe down every single surface, make the beds, clean the bathrooms, vacuum, scrub, and overturn every piece of furniture to ensure the room is spotless. Quickly, I developed immense respect for the back of the house. They worked tirelessly and seamlessly, accomplishing an endless list of tasks without so much as an acknowledgement from most guests. To this day, I strip the bed before leaving a hotel and leave a hefty tip for the housekeepers. I learned this admirable trait from our general manager and my first mentor, Leslie, who was an inspiring leader. I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, and for the first time in years, I felt like I was in over my head. In my previous roles, I felt powerful, confident, and connected. I knew all the regulars, had great relationships with the staff, and was able to make any guest stay above average. A newlywed couple would arrive, and I'd have our staff upgrade them to the presidential suite. When the ballrooms were full and the culinary staff needed help plating dinner for thousands of people, I'd roll up my sleeves and jump on the assembly line. If there was a disturbance like a fight in the bar, I was working with the police to remedy the situation. But in this new role, I felt lost. I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't speak any Spanish, and most of the employees I oversaw didn't speak English. "I can barely keep my own house clean," I thought. How am I supposed to manage dozens of people to do something I don't even know how to do, and without words? The assistant manager who reported to me trained me to do my job. That was humbling to say the least. I had always been boisterous and outgoing, but during this career shift, I became very self-conscious and introverted. I started doubting my abilities, losing confidence, and lacking motivation. The passion I'd once felt for my career was fading, and I started to think I might not be cut out for leadership after all. Was I falling out of love, or was I just not good enough? For months, I struggled to get through the day. By the time I got home from work, I'd flop into bed and try to forget how miserable I was. Each morning was a battle to get up and go to work. It was my first time dealing with such a lack of motivation. On top of that, I started to experience shame for not wanting to go to work in the first place. This was in the late 90s. I didn't know what depression was, and people didn't talk about it back then. At one point, Leslie mentioned noticing a change in my mood. It was official. People were noticing my rapid downward spiral. Nobody suspected I was depressed, not even me. I just thought I was in the wrong position. Surely if I found another job, then everything would change. When Omni offered me a promotion and relocation to Dallas, I leapt at the opportunity. My role would be to address some service issues at the company's flagship hotel, the Omni Las Colinas, which was down the street from the corporate office. This was huge. I had the opportunity to make a name for myself while interacting with the company owners and senior officers. I took the job and moved to Dallas, but made a huge mistake. I left Jess in Austin. The distance took a toll on us, but we were determined to make it work. The drive between us was only 3 hours, so we took turns driving back and forth to see each other. I felt like I had made it to the big leagues at work. On a regular basis, I worked with more celebrities, athletes, and politicians. One of the first was Kelly Clarkson, shortly after winning the very first season of American Idol. She was so sweet. One day, I held the front door open for her, and she walked right up to me and offered a friendly handshake. "Hi, I'm Kelly," she beamed. "Hi, Kelly. I know who you are. We've been rooting for you all season. Congratulations." Around the same time, Omni had introduced a program in which we would bring a treadmill and other fitness supplies to guest rooms for those who wanted to exercise in privacy. This is brilliant, I thought. I ended up buying a treadmill to set up in my living room at home, hoping it might help me get into better shape. It was a game changer for me. I was severely overweight and needed the exercise, but didn't want to trek to a gym and be around dozens of other people. Foolishly, I assumed I could run faster, longer, and more frequently than my body allowed. A few months after buying the treadmill, I injured myself. Badly. I had unknowingly caused several discs in my lower back to bulge, which pinched a nerve and resulted in a shooting pain down my right leg. I ended up taking a leave of absence to undergo my first of many back surgeries. I had no idea this treadmill would be the trigger of years of pain, opioid dependence, and work absence to come. While working for Omni, I had the great honor of traveling the country to train other Omni Hotel employees on a new service initiative. The program was led by our Vice President, Jeff, who is still a highly respected executive with the company today. These trainings are where I developed a love for public speaking, as I was passionate about Omni's core values. If you put me in front of a room full of people, I could talk about the initiative for days. I quickly realized that if I knew what I was talking about and earned the respect of the audience, it was easy. Speaking felt pure and authentic, without fanfare or ego. It wasn't until later in my career that I began to experience intense panic and crippling anxiety before speaking to large groups. Eventually, I discovered that if I had stayed true to myself and talked about what I knew, it was a breeze. Those few years at the Omni in Las Colinas catalyzed my career. I'm grateful to the entire Omni Hotels and Resorts family. Under their leadership and guidance, I learned the true meaning of genuine hospitality and providing exceptional service. Although I would go on to learn valuable lessons throughout my career in the hospitality industry, Omni is still near and dear to my heart. Their executive leadership and core values of empowering their 15,000 employees remain second to none. By 2003, after 8 wonderful years with Omni, I was ready to go back to Austin. I still owned a home there and was eager to get back with Jess. Unfortunately, the only opening Omni had in Austin was back in housekeeping, which I had no desire to pursue. One of my best friends at the time, Mario, sent me a lead on a management position at a valet parking company called Town Park. Man, this is a multi-billion dollar industry. If you're looking for a change and want to grow, this is your shot. Parking industry? That's a thing? Apparently, people spend billions of dollars a year to park at hotels, hospitals, airports, and downtown office buildings. And someone's gotta manage all of that. Town Park was a national company based in Annapolis, Maryland, and they were growing rapidly. I knew some hotels outsourced their valet parking and garage management, but didn't realize it was such a successful industry. I joined Town Park as a location manager. At the time, a gentleman named Eric was the district manager, and we formed a friendship that has lasted to this day. When he was promoted, I moved into his old position as district manager overseeing Austin. Had he not granted me that opportunity, I may have never excelled in the parking industry. Omni taught me everything about service and relationships, but Town Park taught me about leadership and how to run a business. The company was growing at a record pace from coast to coast. To sustain that growth, it was critical that we continue recruiting and developing future leaders and remain hyper-focused on profits. It was not easy for a company to build an enthusiastic culture, but Town Park had a special sauce. We called it lightning in a bottle. They knew how to motivate thousands of valet drivers and managers to excel every day. They adopted a leadership method called the Four Disciplines of Execution, created by Stephen Covey, alumni Chris McChesney. This process allowed Town Park to roll out their most important initiatives nationally, and every single employee across the country could tell you what their specific goals were. For example, a Marriott Orlando's goal might be to ensure every valet car is retrieved for the guest in under 3 minutes, while the Gaylord Resort in Washington, D.C.'s goal is to achieve a 90% or higher guest satisfaction score. It was all about identifying the most important priority at hundreds of hotels, then keeping score while rallying the troops to succeed. I believe it was that process and framework that engaged and excited close to 20,000 employees across the nation. This, along with the inspiring leadership of Town Park's executives, created what we called a sustainable and competitive advantage. The other genius of Town Park was their ability to raise capital to fuel their growth. Not only did they attract successful private equity groups to invest while still maintaining majority ownership, but they allowed senior leaders to invest as well. Understandably, the first round was open only to those who had been with the organization for an extended time and who had made significant contributions over the years. I was fortunate enough to invest in the second round. I rolled the dice and cashed in my 401k. I was all in. I have several friends who turned what would be the equivalent of paying cash for a new car into millions, and they deserved every bit of it. Several of them would go on to start their own companies in a variety of industries, and I couldn't be happier for them. Had I known the investments would be so successful, I would have leveraged every opportunity possible as others did. I would have maxed out my credit cards and borrowed money to optimize potential profits. This experience taught me that entrepreneurship is not just about a paycheck. Once you invest into the equity of a company, you're also invested in their performance. This created a whole new understanding of how to create a culture of loyalty and investment, not just at the individual level, but the collective. I had always wondered what it might be like to run my own business. and I clocked this experience as something worth remembering if I ever did. Town Park was led by founder Jerry South. Jerry was a true visionary leader who started the company in 1988 when he won the contract to oversee the parking at the Lowe's Hotel in Annapolis, Maryland. Over the next several decades, Town Park would provide parking management to some of the finest hotels across the country. Four Seasons, Mandarin Orientals, Ritz-Carltons, and yes, even Omni Hotels. Jerry had figured out early on that if you surround yourself with other highly talented people, you can harness their focus and energy for the good of the whole. He recruited a small army of talented executives with decades of experience in operations and hospitality. Jerry often said, "If you think you're the smartest one in the room, you have a bigger problem than you think." The company was full of talented executives, but our vice president, Matt Cahill, inspired us most. Matt was a charismatic leader who helped build the framework for the company's explosive growth. He was a dynamic executive who had worked his way up the ranks, paving a path that we all aspired to follow. It was easy to get lost in the minutiae of statistics and the daily grind, but Matt made it look effortless. He was my mentor and true friend, and he's widely known in the parking and hospitality industries as one of the greats. Today, he is the president and one of the principal owners of another tremendously successful parking management company based in Nashville, Tennessee. My career was growing. I was building solid professional relationships, learning from the best, and gaining momentum. These felt like peak years, and there was only one thing left for me to feel truly on top of the world: to have Jess along for the journey with me. Chapter 3: Tears of Joy. Jess and I stayed in Austin for the next several years, living just minutes from my parents on the south side of town. She was pursuing her passion, which was studying to become a massage therapist. This seemed like a perfect fit for her. She had a nurturing soul and a desire to help others. I had no idea how extensive the training for this field was. It required a minimum of 500 hours of board-certified education in biology, kinesiology, and dozens of different modalities. Afterward, she had to pass grueling exams and register with the state. I gained a whole new respect for folks in this field and learned it wasn't just about giving someone a good shoulder rub. Jess can bring me to my knees with just two fingers if she wants, and she has. We had formed several close friendships while working at the Omni. We became inseparable, just three couples that had all met working in the hotel industry. We spent our days off on our boat on Lake Travis or Lake Austin, playing golf and enjoying the nightlife on 6th Street in downtown Austin. Looking back, I wish I had the foresight to embrace those years of innocence. We were free of worry, stress, and the hardships that would come later in life. For the most part, my mind was clear and free of depression or anxiety. After a few years in Austin, I was offered an opportunity to relocate to Baltimore and oversee that market for Town Park. This was a great opportunity to work right near the home office in Annapolis and interact with the company's owners. I was in, but knew I needed to solidify my relationships with Jess before pursuing this new endeavor. I started thinking about proposing. I've often wondered how many trips I took Jess on before she started to doubt that I'd ever ask her to marry me. Will he finally pop the question while eating Cuban food in Miami or watching those fireworks over the Rocky Mountains in Denver? I was oblivious. It had been 7 years since our first date, and I still had no idea why she waited that long for me. I was 29, she was 31, and I knew that for us to make this leap together, we needed to make it official. So I came up with a plan. We'd take a cruise, which was something we had always wanted to do. It seemed like the perfect opportunity for me to finally pop the question. Right before boarding the cruise ship in Galveston, I called her mom to ask for her blessing. "It's about time," she squealed. Our first stop on the cruise was Key West, and we had plans to go snorkeling. I had the ring in my pocket, which, in retrospect, was absolutely bonkers considering we'd be diving into the ocean. I wasn't quite sure how it was going to play out, but I knew this was the day I wanted to propose. Thankfully, I talked myself out of taking the ring snorkeling. Despite wanting to somehow propose while surrounded by tropical fish, the idea of the ring floating to the bottom of the Atlantic seemed like a bad way to begin an engagement. After diving, we took a stroll around Key West. My heart was pounding in my chest. I wanted to make this special, and I was terrified my plan, no plan, might not be good enough. Eventually, we decided to stop at a little cafe called Kermit's Key Lime Pie Shop. We sat at the back patio and ate the best key lime pie either of us had ever had. The night was slowly slipping away, and I knew if I didn't propose now, I'd lose the chance. I fumbled to open the mahogany box. My palms were sticky with sweat, and my heart was beating so fast, I thought I might actually be having a heart attack. I wanted to tell her how much she meant to me, how I wanted to spend the rest of our lives together, and how lucky I felt to know her. But I was nervous, and all that came out of my mouth as I opened the box was, "Will you marry me?" She seemed genuinely surprised. In retrospect, she could have just been acting surprised to make me feel better. Either way, she wanted to marry me, and said yes. As if coming out of a trance, the sounds of cheers on the patio nearby started to fade into my consciousness, and I realized we were surrounded by people clapping for us as a newly engaged couple. Our hearts were full. We spent the rest of the cruise indulging in food, in the sun, and each other. We ate steak and lobster every night, swam with stingrays in Grand Cayman, made new friends, and spent as much time as possible together. At one point, we drank so many cocktails on a stop in Cozumel that we almost missed the boat. We soaked up every last moment before returning to Austin. When we got home from our cruise, we packed up to make the move to Baltimore. Right around the same time, several of our closest friends were moving to Richmond, Virginia. It was perfect. We would only be a few hours away from each other for this new chapter in our lives. On New Year's Day of 2006, we caravaned as a group across the country to our new homes, stopping at Waffle Houses and diners along the way. Jess and I loved Baltimore. We rented a small home just big enough for us and our two dogs. The house was in a charming area called Ellicott City and had a backyard facing the picturesque Patapsco State Park. We could literally walk out our back door and within minutes be standing on the most incredible perch, overlooking a massive ravine full of rocky waves, catching all four seasons of foliage in the trees. We spent the first year in Baltimore planning our wedding. The date was set for October of 2006 with our friends and family back in Austin. A small wedding, about 75 people, perfect for us. Up until this point, I hadn't experienced any more noticeable depression. I had always been wound a little tight, so I supposed I dealt with regular anxiety and nerves about work. I chalked it up to a bit of social awkwardness while I tried to pretend like I was Mr. Social. Despite the immense joy and optimism I was feeling about getting married, many of my days were marked with stress and anxiety. I was sleeping less, and my thoughts were more jumbled and muddled than before. Still, I wanted to make our wedding special for Jess. I decided to put together a video compilation of our years together to surprise her. The night before our wedding, I stayed at Mario's house. I watched the video from start to finish to make sure it was perfect. I was suddenly overcome with emotion and started crying. Why am I crying right now? Are these tears of joy? I've never been much of a crier, and the tears confused me. I genuinely wasn't sure why I broke down into tears and tried to brush it off. The next day, the groomsmen and I were getting ready in one room, the bridesmaid and Jess in another. Some of the guys had flasks of whiskey and were indulging. I took a sip and wanted to take a few more to calm my nerves. But I didn't want to be the guy who was clearly hammered at his own wedding, so I took it easy. While getting dressed, I heard a knock at the door. It was one of the girls who had an envelope for me. Jess sent the most heartfelt card declaring her love, along with an engraved money clip that I still have today. I had no idea that it was customary to send each other a symbol of love before the ceremony. I jokingly blamed my groomsmen. Hey guys, someone should have told me about this. I had nothing to send her and felt like a total dummy. The time had finally arrived, and I was a bundle of nerves. I took my place at the altar, waiting for Jess to walk down the aisle. When she started to walk towards me, I became overwhelmed with emotion. Halfway down the aisle, Jess had to stop because her garter had fallen down her leg and was wrapped around her ankle. While her mom and stepdad helped her put it back in place, the guests exchanged laughs and friendly giggles. It was a perfect moment of levity, and I was grateful for the comic relief. She walked the rest of the way to the altar surrounded by our closest friends and family, all giddy from a good laugh and beaming with love for both of us. My heart was racing. I couldn't believe how lucky I was. I was marrying the love of my life. We held hands while the pastor read a few words.
Okay, you can do this, Russell. Just repeat what the pastor says.
Repeat after me. I, Russell Harms. I, Russell Harms. I barely made it 10 seconds before I burst into tears. What on earth is happening to me? I was mortified. Jess had rarely seen me cry, and I just prayed she thought it was sweet or a sign of my love. She wiped away my tears, and we said, I do. We were married, and I was on cloud 9. Ironically, my friend and mentor Matt from Town Park had also taken the scenic route to the altar, getting married to his longtime love, Shannon, the night before Louisville. Several of our friends had made the trek from the East Coast to Matt and Shannon's wedding in the Midwest and then to ours in Texas. Matt and I would later joke about those moments at the altar. He had also felt the tears welling up but maintained his composure. Not me, though. I wore my emotions on my sleeve for all to see in plain view. My embarrassment about crying in front of all our friends and family lasted for years. I still dwell on that moment with embarrassment every time I see or think about a wedding. I was genuinely confused by the flood of emotions I felt in those 2 days. I didn't know that crying like that was a natural release. Nobody had ever taught me about my basic human emotions. My internal world was a mystery to me, and I was clueless about the fact that things like poor sleep, general stress, or the anticipation of something joyful can dysregulate the human body. For years, I'd operated this way, unaware of my own body's physiological needs and response to the world, confused by my emotions, and in constant denial that it was okay to not be okay. I was used to putting on a show, even though I was terrified inside. I knew so many guys that had the world at their feet who seemed so confident, so at ease. Was it real or were they faking their way through it like me? Is everyone pretending or is it just me? The next day, we were off to another cruise to celebrate our honeymoon. This time, we swam with the dolphins in Grand Cayman, braved the water slides at the Atlantis in the Bahamas, and rode horses up the hillside and into the ocean in Jamaica. We've both spent the previous year working out together at a nearby gym in Ellicott City, and were in the best shape of our lives. We knew the endless array of buffets and fine dining on the cruise ship would make that hard to maintain. We didn't care, though. We indulged together and enjoyed every bit of it. And I mean every bit. 9 months later, we welcomed our first son, Carter. If you're a parent, you know the joy that comes with welcoming a child into the world, which is something I never understood until that time. We decided not to know in advance if we were having a boy or a girl, which made it even that more exciting. Obviously, we would have been elated to have either, as long as they were happy and healthy. I, for one, was secretly hoping for at least one boy to play catch with, go on adventures with, and to carry on my family legacy. We were over the moon when the doctor said, "It's a boy," as Carter arrived.
I thought I was prepared for the actual birthing part. I'd been to all the checkups along the way, attended Lamaze classes, and Jess had been educating me on what to expect. But no one told me about something called the conehead effect. When our little guy popped out, he looked like a baby alien with an oddly shaped cone head. The nurses quickly cleaned him up, put a blue beanie over his tiny head, then wrapped him in warm blankets and set him on Jess's bare chest. I had no clue what was going on, but the nurses quickly assured me it was common, and his little noggin was perfectly fine shortly after. 3 months later, we celebrated our first anniversary on the patio at McCormick & Schmick's, overlooking the scenic Baltimore Inner Harbor. Just across the water, Jess's favorite band, Big Head Todd, was playing at the Pier 6 Pavilion. We couldn't take our three-month-old to a concert, so instead we enjoyed our dinner a few hundred feet away, listening from our table late into the night. I'm convinced that Jess and baby Carter had formulated a plan together. He insisted she hold him right as dinner arrived, forcing me to crack Jess's crab legs, drench them in salty butter, and hand-feed her the entire meal. It was hilarious, and we were creating our first memories as a family. Those years were such joyous times. We had each other and our new bundle of joy, and we were on top of the world. After another year in Baltimore, we were able to transfer to Houston, where we would be closer to our friends and family, a few hours away in Austin. Little did I know, this transition would mark the beginning of a downward spiral. One, none of us could have predicted.
So there it is, the first three chapters of Euphoric Misery. If you go to parkingcast.com/shop, there is information on how you can purchase the book or audiobook. I put that link in the show notes as well, so just click the link there. Remember to check in with a loved one today and ask them how they're doing. Thanks for listening and have a great rest of your week. This episode is brought to you by our gold sponsor, Park Mobile. Park Mobile, a part of the Easy Park Group, is the leading provider of smart parking and mobility solutions in North America, using a contactless approach to help millions of people easily find, reserve, and pay for parking on their mobile devices. Learn more at parkmobile.io. This episode is brought to you by Parkalytics, a company I'm very excited about. Parkalytics uses drones to capture images and then specialized software to perform vehicle counts, utilization reports, and turnover studies. Parking consultants can now perform in-depth parking studies for off-street lots, on-street parking, and vehicular traffic without ever having to leave their home for a fraction of the price of a traditional parking study. Parking operators can use this tool to get accurate parking data to make better decisions on lease management deals. The list goes on and on. But check it out for yourself at parkalytics.com or click the link in the show notes. This episode is brought to you by Breeze, Parking Concepts' digital platform that makes the parking experience a breeze. For more than 50 years, PCI has been proactively managing parking and transportation operations with unparalleled integrity and service. Learn more at parkingconcepts.com.